Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the reconvened meeting of the Overview and Scrutiny Board for the call-in. Before we start, I would just like to go through some public announcements. Firstly, we are not expecting a fire alarm, but if there is one, then looking at my hand, if you would, please, through the door and through the door down in the corridor out into the car park, where a roll call will be taken. Could we please all check our mobile phones to ensure they are either off or on silent? The toilets, again, looking at my hand, are through the door on my front left. Turn left at the first hallway, and the ladies is on the left and the gentleman next one down. As ever, when I'm chairing these meetings, I will require, please, respect for the person that is speaking and courtesy in speaking. I only want to have the one person that is speaking being listened to. I would certainly myself stop any interruptions because it is discourteous to whoever is speaking. No deviation from the points either, please. There are a number of pink papers handed around to elected members. Please, when the meeting is over, could you make sure that you personally hand those back to Kate, because they are not for circulation. If any member wants to, and I say again, any member, it doesn't have to be a member around this table, any member wants to raise any questions on the pink paper, then I will put the requirement to go to part two to this board for voting. And on the basis that this board has no objection to that, then I will go into part two, which will mean that the public in the room will need to be excused for the room during the duration of the discussion on that pink paper. And, of course, at the end of the discussion on the pink paper, we will arrange for the good ladies and gentlemen of the public to come back in. Okay, moving on now, as I said, this is the reconvened meeting, and it does have to be finished tonight. We got to the stage in the meeting where Steve Paddock, Charles Uzzell and Anne-Marie Bond had provided answers to questions which had been posed at that moment. However, there were, as a number of people thought there may well have been, a number of supplementary questions which, in fairness to the officers, required them to be given time so that they could consider fully the response to those questions. We are now at that point. So we will move on to that point, and then after all the questions have been asked, and indeed there may be questions from any member around the floor, I will allow that, because I do want it to be open and transparent. Then we will move on to the Mayor. The Mayor has asked if he could sit where he is, and I have absolutely no problem with that whatsoever. Then Councillor Morey will sum up the reasons for the call-in. The Mayor will sum up the reasons, the response to the call-in notice, and then we move to the business of the evening, which is for the members of the board to debate. Now, I will explain at the time we come to that moment what the options are, but I would like now, if I could, please, to move to the officers, the various questions that were answered. We have had papers, but perhaps if the officers do want to address them, then they can do that in whichever sequence they like. Thank you.
Chairman, should I suggest we go through in number order?
Lead the way.
Okay, I'll start with question one. The valuation of the land by an independent valuer was requested. The papers say it's not been possible to gain that in the time. Actually, today we've had confirmation from the district valuer that the response given in question five at the last meeting was actually correct, and they endorsed the analysis that the TDA provided. And you'll recall that that gave a difference in value of 6,868,000 pounds. The first and the 18th without permission on was valued at 132,000, and with permission for the residential development it was valued at 7 million. So the difference in value is one minus the other.
Other answers to the questions from anyone? Do you want to go through any of the others? No? Anne-Marie?
I will take the second question, and there were two similar questions, one raised by Mr. Haddock during his presentation on the last occasion, another one raised by Councillor Tynan, but both of those related to whether there were any existing covenants on the land. I've been able to clarify in the intervening period that the golf club lease is subject to covenants that are detailed in the conveyance from 1972, and that conveyance is referenced in the 2003 golf club lease. The relevant covenant states that the purchaser, which was Torbay Council, will not use the golf club land except in such a way that there will be an 18-hole golf course, as long as there is public demand for the same. There are issues that were raised by Mr. Haddock on the last occasion as to the maintenance of boundaries, but that is not of relevance to the consideration of the proposed covenant.
Thank you, Amy Rand. Any other officer, any other question, please? No. Okay, thank you.
You want to move on to now, Kate? Thank you, Chair. Question three.
Okay.
I think the question should be the report wrongly assumes that the planning permission for the first and 18th hole is deliverable rather than undeliverable. I think it should read that, but the answer remains the same anyway, if that's okay. At the last meeting of the Overreach and Scrutiny Board, we advised of the risk that discussions held at the board meeting and recommendations by the board could undermine the council's position at the forthcoming public inquiry relating to the Chesnut Golf Course new clubhouse and at the local plan examination. The council's position as local planning authority on this site is quite clear. The 1st and 18th is a deliverable site, featuring the council's five-year land supply and in the local plan. The council's position as landowner is also clear. There's no contract that allows development of the 1st and 18th, but this or a future administration could agree to a new contract relatively quickly. I'll just set out the planning permission, planning position, if you like, Chair, and that helps clarify the position in terms of deliverability. Outline planning permission for delivery of 132 new homes on the 1st and 18th was granted in December 2012. Consequently, all reserve matters need to be submitted by December 2012 in 2015. December 2015, to be clear, in order to keep the outline permission alive. There is then 2 years from the date of that approval of the final reserve matters within which development must be commenced. A reserve matters application covering just design and appearance has already been submitted and approved for the 42 sheltered units. As the principle of development has been accepted by the council, reserve matters applications will deal with issues such as design and landscaping. Reserve matters applications could be submitted and the outline permission kept alive even if the clubhouse appeal was dismissed, i.e. planning permission is not granted by the inspector. So just touching on the barriers to delivery, I talked last time about delivery being a little tricky. Obviously one of those issues is the lease. The second one is a provision of a new clubhouse. So the one planning barrier to delivery of the development of the 1st and 18th is planning permission for a relocated clubhouse. The appellants, in relation to the clubhouse appeal, argue that the 1st and 18th is an important site for housing, as the council does not have, as they contend, a five-year land supply. They argue this is a good reason for the inspector to allow the appeal for the clubhouse. As such, it seems odd for the community to suggest at this time that the 1st and 18th is not deliverable, as this might be considered as providing support for the proposed clubhouse. If the inspector allows the appeal, and hence gives permission for the proposed clubhouse, there's nothing in planning terms to prevent delivery of the 1st and 18th. In planning terms, I emphasise. So, until the outcomes of the Churston Golf Club planning appeal and the local plan examination are known, the council must continue to consider the site as deliverable. It should be noted the site is considered as deliverable in the council's refreshed strategic housing land availability assessment, which dated July 2013, which forms a key piece of evidence to support the new local plan. That work was undertaken with the council, landowners, the community, house builders and developers. The National Planning Policy Framework defines deliverable as follows, and I think it's important that I provide the full quote. To be considered deliverable, sites should be available now, offer a suitable location for development, and be achievable with a realistic prospect that housing will be delivered on the site within 5 years, and in particular, that development of the site is viable. Sites with planning permission should be considered deliverable until permission expires, unless there is clear evidence that schemes will not be implemented within 5 years. For example, they will not be viable. There is no longer a demand for the type of units or sites. All sites have long-term phasing plans. In other words, they take longer than 5 years to deliver. So that raises three tests. First of all, availability. In planning terms, the site is considered as available, especially as it has planning permission. In land ownership terms, a new contract with Blaws or another developer and the golf club could be in place relatively quickly, as I advised previously. The second test is in relation to location. The Council's Development Management Committee has agreed the location of the site to be suitable for development by granting outline planning permission. The Council has agreed to inclusion of the site within the new local plan. Third test, achievable. In the current market conditions, the development is considered as achievable, viable and capable of being delivered in the next 5 years. I won't read the second half of that paragraph, I've already given you most of it, Chair. Consequently, officers consider the site to be deliverable in accordance with the MPBF. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Any other comments, any comments or responses from any of the officers? No, thank you. Steve, could I just ask you, please, if you could, for my benefit, just expand slightly on the argument that you put forward last week on the potential damage or perceived damage or alleged damage that may occur to the economy?
I think the question I answered was whether this might deter inward investment, and I answered that I thought it could. Just to cover that ground and elaborate, the council obviously owns significant land within the vicinity, identified in the local plan for development, whether that be housing or employment. In order to bring that land forward for development, the council would either need to sell that land or seek development partners. If there is a prospect that the council might receive petitions which put covenants restricting development on that, on those assets, then clearly the investor is going to be deterred from looking seriously at those assets. Potentially, the council could gain a reputation for being anti-development. I wouldn't overstate that, but there is that potential risk. Normally, when a developer will look at the site and think about investing in a particular development, the first thing that they will go to is the local plan to see whether the land has been allocated for development. That is the framework policy that's been through rigorous scrutiny, an independent inspection, has been through grassroots democracy in terms of the way it's been built up. Normally, they wouldn't expect to have the risk of a petition leading to a covenant being imposed on the land. I did hear Anne-Marie's legal advice that this does not set a precedent, but actually a developer will look at what has happened previously and what the reaction has been. I'm going to go into dangerous territory, perhaps, Chairman, in terms of politics, and forgive me if I do too far. One of the reasons that I personally would prefer to rely on the local plan to determine such matters is that the local plan is a long-term document, has been delivered over a long term and is intended to be for the long term. It's not susceptible to short-term political pressures. It can't be, the allocation of land within it cannot be bartered away for political expediency or necessity. So personally, I would put my faith in the local plan if I was an inward investor and prefer not to have the risk of changes to the allocation of land through petitions, covenants and political intervention.
Thank you very much indeed. Yeah, I'm coming to that now, Jackie. And yes is the answer, certainly. The papers in front of you, members of the board, under agenda item 2, which is in front of you, there are a number of questions there which you posed last time. If there's any of them that you want to get a full answer from them, please feel free to do so. But to Jackie, you first.
Mine is to Steve again, please. Obviously, in overview and scrutiny, we look at capital receipts, and it's been pointed out recently that capital receipts so far this year are actually down. How do you see the potential loss of these capital receipts impacting on further capital investment?
Jackie, I don't think I would say that capital receipts this year are down. In fact, we've sold more assets over the last 2 to 3 years than previously. But it is clear that in order to have a sustainable capital programme, we need to sell more assets. I think in the previous meeting, we discussed what the potential reduction in capital value could be, and lots of ifs here, if the other assets identified in the local plan owned in council ownership were to have restricted covenants put on. I think the reduction was £47 million. £47 million. That is if the covenant is placed. Of course, there is the risk of the covenant being placed, or the risk of a petition leading to a restriction, particularly after the developer maybe has incurred quite a lot of money, which then provokes the petition being raised. So I think there's a very significant impact upon the council's future capital receipts. The worst possible case is £47 million. Clearly, it wouldn't be that, because not every asset would have the potential risk, but it's significant.
Anne-Marie Bond, you wanted to come in.
Chairman, if I could, before we move on from the point, Steve referenced the fact that on the last occasion I said that it didn't create a precedent. And I don't think that's actually what I said on the last occasion. I said it wouldn't create a legal precedent because that can only be created by the courts and judicial rulings. However, the council do have a duty to act consistently and fairly. And in the granting of covenants previously, in considering new requests, the council would have to consider what it had decided previously, and acting consistently would need to follow the same. Otherwise, there would be a chance of irrationality.
Thank you for the guidance.
Can I, again, Steve Parrock, question whether you believe that this covenant, if granted at this stage, would have any impact on any developments that are currently ongoing, or are we only looking at potential impact on future ones that are really not yet started or not past the first hurdle anyway?
I think there are assets which could be impacted by today's or by the outcome of the decision in due course. For example, there's land identified in the local plan for housing which we expect to be brought forward over the next 5 years in council ownership. Undoubtedly, when we go to the market with that land, there will be a cloud potentially over that land, whether there is going to be a public upswell against the development of houses on that land, which could lead to a petition, which could lead to a covenant, which could lead to the land being withdrawn after we've sought expressions of interest and potentially would investors have investigated the site. That's one example. I mentioned last time Kerry Green. Clearly, there's no petition out there to put a covenant on Kerry Green presently, but that could materialise. The developer has probably spent the best part of £300,000 or £400,000. Council has already agreed in principle to lease the land, and there would be some doubt in the developer's mind whether a covenant was likely to be forthcoming on that land. I don't think that's necessarily a great example, but that's a possibility, and so we need to be mindful of that.
Nothing else, Councillor Clement?
The first one I didn't think fell into the category of what I would have defined as on current developments, but the second one probably is. Is that the only example you see of a current development that you think could be affected? I'm thinking of areas like the Great Parks development where we're already through outline, but there are bits of land within there, I believe, that the council own.
Page 74 of last week's report identifies the sites that the council owns which are identified in the local plan for development. All of those sites could be impacted by a decision to place a covenant on Churston.
Okay, thank you. Councillor Parrott, you wanted to question.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you for your indulgence. I asked question 4, which is on page 89 of the new document today. The reason I asked is it goes really to the core of democracy, and it's a principle in British democracy that one administration doesn't bind a succeeding administration. And thank you, Anne-Marie, for focusing on Churston, and that's a very clear answer. But my question goes a bit wider than that, and in many ways covers something that you spoke about just now, Anne-Marie, and that is to what extent would this decision being made now affect, say, and I'll give you another scenario, you know, July next year, along comes a petition for land in Preston, say, then the papers come before the mayor and they say, Mr. Mayor or Mrs. Mayor or whoever it is, of course, you know, you have to agree this, because Mayor Oliver in last year approved the Churston Covenant. And the reason you must agree it is, A, because we might be acting irrationally or whatever the terminology is, but and secondly, and perhaps even more fundamentally, we couldn't afford the court case that would ensue, if this was challenged through the courts. So what I'm saying is your advice that making this decision in those terms would actually bind a future administration? I think it's something we must be very, very clear about. Thank you, Chairman.
I addressed it on the last occasion, and actually, obviously, I answered question four slightly differently than that. I didn't interpret the question in that way, but actually it comes up in response to question seven. So, Chair, I'll address question seven within this now, in that authorities need to act consistently and fairly in all of its decision-making, and that lasts throughout and over political and administrative changes. So if the council were to expand its criteria upon which it decided to grant covenants, and I gave in the answer to question seven, I attempted to set out some of the characteristics of the covenants that have been granted already in respect of Babbicombe and in respect of Paynton Green. That is the criteria which currently we would be judged against in terms of that, acting reasonably and consistently and rationally in deciding future covenants. If this covenant is granted, then that would expand the criteria by which we would need to judge future requests.
Chairman, just to clarify, so a future mayor making a different decision wouldn't expand the criteria, it would go against the existing criteria, is that correct? So you would be in effect binding the next administration?
Yes.
Thank you.
Unless it's possible to distinguish it on specific facts.
I think it would be useful if we went through the questions and item on the agenda, simply because the public haven't been privileged to the answers in our paper. But before we do that, Michael Hutch, you'd like got a question, sir.
Reminding me. Yes, it's about little three on item, agenda item two. And he said that in granting...
I
beg your pardon. I stand corrected. I can't read that out.
Didn't see the colour of the paper, Michael. I apologise.
Yes,
can we move on? We can go into part two at an appropriate time, and it may or may not be appropriate. Okay.
Can we ask another legal
question? Certainly.
I'm sorry, Anne-Marie, but I know we've had this discussion, but could you clarify something for me again? My understanding of the Local Government Act 2009 and the DCLG advice about appropriate and inappropriate petitions. My understanding of it was that a petition could be inappropriate where the subject matter was part of a legal ongoing I don't know what the word is, I'm trying to think, dispute. Could we get ourselves in trouble by accepting a petition such as this when there are already, legal matters ensuing?
The council's constitution sets out the criteria by which this council decides its petitions. There is a provision within it that petitions can be refused if they are deemed otherwise objectionable, and that's clearly quite a wide reference. The ability to determine that is given to the executive director with support from the monitoring officer. And it's in that consideration, it was our view that the ongoing planning appeal did not impact upon the acceptance of this petition.
Okay, Councillor Pritchard.
Thank you very much, Chair. I asked question seven, and I thank officers and Anne-Marie in particular for your answer. But through you, Chair, Councillor Parrott's question, and I apologise through you to Councillor Parrott if I've misinterpreted this, but it intimated, certainly to me, that this decision or any future decision would go against existing criteria. I think I quote there. Can I ask officers to clarify, please, that there are no existing criteria for covenants, and indeed there is no covenants policy, and that indeed the opening sentence of the answer to question seven suggests that at the moment each decision should turn on its own facts. I'd just like to clarify that there are no criteria at present that we're working towards. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, in terms of a policy, no, there is no such policy, and therefore there are no formal criteria contained within such. However, when one looks at our responsibility to act consistently and fairly, you would compare the Council's decision-making previously to give guidance as to it in the future. It would be a recommendation of mine, Chair, that in the future we did have such a policy to guide decision-making.
Councillor Mills. Okay, thank you very much indeed. Perhaps we could go through the agenda item now. We've done four. Could we have five? I don't know who asked the question, but I'll read it anyway. Is it possible for the development...
Chair, I don't think we've completed all of the questions within three at the moment.
Okay, I apologise.
I think we'd got to 3B.
Yeah, we did.
Got that. Okay.
It's not mine. Are you going to do that one?
Chairman, 3B, is okay if we pick that when we get to question six? There's quite a lot of information outlined there on that one.
Okay, thank you.
I will take over at 3C then, and the question was that the report wrongly assumes that the covenant is a no development covenant. It's clear that the covenant is not a no development covenant. Firstly, the proposed covenant does not apply to any development that's within the permitted user clause of the lease with the golf club. So that is anything to do with the running of the land as a golf club or as agriculture. And secondly, the proposed covenant only prevents development on the land without first obtaining the agreement of the majority of the resident at a referendum.
Thank you. And who's doing D?
Are there any questions on that before I move to D?
Thank you, Chairman. Anne-Marie, you just said the last sentence in that C is, secondly, proposed covenant says without first obtaining the agreement of the majority of the residents. Is that actually the case? It has to be the majority of the residents.
That's the wording of the proposed covenant,
okay,
yes.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much.
Councillor Pritchard.
Sorry, Chair, I'd just like to clarify. I would follow up on Councillor Bent's question because I would like that clarified, because my understanding is it's the wording slightly more technical than that. It's the majority of residents who are entitled to vote at an election and are on the electoral roll at that point, which is substantially different from all the residents, I think.
I apologise. Councillor Pritchard's correct in that respect.
Thank you. Okay. D.
Chair, the question was that the report wrongly fails to explain that the covenant is not a disposal. Council officers are of the firm belief that the proposed covenant is classed as a disposal. The reasoning for that is that under the 1972 Local Government Act, land is defined as any interest in land and any easement or right in, to or over land. The benefit of a restrictive covenant is an equitable interest in land, and therefore the grant of the restrictive covenant does involve a disposal within the meaning of the Act. Chair, I've today had discussions with Mr. Billings as to his contrary view on that, and he has referenced some case law. My understanding of that case law at the moment is that doesn't impact upon the view of officers that this is a disposal. However, that is something that I will continue to look at following this meeting, Chair.
Thank you very much indeed. There's no D. Can we move on to 5, please? On page 90.
Me again. The simple answer to this one is no. The user clause in the lease specifies that the land must be used as a golf club or as agricultural land. Any amendment to that lease would require the consent of not only the mayor but also the golf club.
From members on that one, no. Thank you. 6, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think the suggestion is here under this question, which is to offer up sites identified by the community as part of the Brixham neighbourhood planning process as a substitute for the loss of new homes on the 1st and 18th. In summary, the suggestion, if implemented, would leapfrog essential legally required components of the plan-making process. It would, if those sites were put forward now by the Council for the local plan, result in postponement of the local plan hearing and a significant delay to adoption of the local plan for the reasons given in answer to question three of the call-in notice previously. For reasons given below, the sites could not be included in the council's five-year land supply. There is simply no certainty yet that the sites will remain within the neighbourhood plan. The sites need to be fully tested. They don't have planning permission. There is a lack of clarity and consistency on the numbers of new homes from some sites. For all these reasons, the substituting of the 1st and 18th by other smaller sites identified by the community could not be supported by officers. This is also supported by advice from consultants supported by the Brixham Neighbourhood Forum. The Council's professional planning officers and the Neighbourhood Forum's own consultants have provided advice on the Brixham Peninsula Neighbourhood Forum, to the Brixham Peninsula Neighbourhood Forum about the status of those sites in strategic planning terms. The Forum's own consultant has provided lots of comment on the emerging draft neighbourhood plan and expressed real concern about the deliverability of some sites and the sorts of housing numbers that the community has suggested for some of those sites. I just think it's important just to explain a bit of context about the way in which local and neighbourhood plans work together. That's particularly important on the sort of localism point, if you like. There has long been an agreement between the council producing a local plan and forums producing neighbourhood plans in two ways. First of all, the council would allocate the sites to come forward in the first 5 years, at least, of the local plan, and those strategic sites or areas that, such as Torquay Gateway, that might come forward over a much longer term. Secondly, neighbourhood forums in their neighbourhood plans would allocate sites for the medium term, roughly years 2018 to 2027, although it's acknowledged that some sites may come forward sooner, some later. This is explicitly recognised in the emerging draft of Brixham Peninsula Neighbourhood Plan, and the local plan provides a pool of sites for each forum to choose from. That approach, Chair, recognises the importance of localism and neighbourhood planning, but also gives comfort to the local plan inspector that the council has identified in its local plan sufficient land to deliver the 9,300 homes, approximately, set out in the local plan. It's an important part of the process. I just need to deal with two main issues. Sorry, a few more than two, actually, four main issues. First of all, the status of the neighbourhood plan. The neighbourhood plan has not been through a pre-submission consultation process, is nowhere near a referendum, and has not been through a sustainability appraisal. Under this test, the Brixham Peninsula Neighbourhood Plan has no weight in planning terms, and that's the same as the advice I've given to various development manager committees over the last few months. New national planning policy guidance makes it clear, whilst a referendum ensures that the community has the final say on whether the neighbourhood plan comes into force, decision makers should respect evidence of local support prior to the referendum when seeking to apply weight to an emerging neighbourhood plan. The consultation statement submitted with the draft neighbourhood plan should reveal the quality and effectiveness of the consultation that has informed the plan proposals. From this guidance, it's clear to the Council that the evidence of local support can only be assessed at the time of production of a formal draft neighbourhood plan with a supporting consultation document, and that local in this case should be defined as Brixham Peninsula, not just a community partnership area. However, the Council could, if the Board think it worthwhile, seek DCLG's further advice on this matter. Just turning now to the status of the sites put forward by Churston Gampton and Broadsands Community Partnership. The key point here is there's been no formal assessment of whether the sites are acceptable or deliverable. The Council has suggested a mini strategic housing availability process to assess the sites in terms of constraints and deliverability. This has not yet been undertaken, but it's particularly as important as, for example, the community has identified sites for development that the local plan Schlar work rejected. In addition, the community has added sites and increased housing numbers on some of those sites. And I just thought it worthwhile giving a few examples. Under the heading of one particular policy in the draft neighbourhood plan, the community has identified Broadhaven, a site in Broadhaven, Broadsands. There's a current planning application for that site for eight residential units. The community partnerships have objected to it on the grounds of the impact on the residential area. That's fine. The Schlar itself suggests up to eight units. There's a second site, Waterside Quarry. The local plan Schlar says the site as a whole is unlikely to achieve six new homes, but the community has identified the site as capable of accommodating 10 homes. In fact, the Development Management Committee has already resolved to approve outline planning permission for three detached dwellings on the northern part of that site. So notwithstanding the professional advice contained in the local plan Schlar and the community's objection to 8 homes on the Broadhaven site, the community suggested that the emerging neighbourhood plan identifies 15 to 25 units in total for the two sites. We think a total of 14 is more likely. So the mini Schlar suggested by the council will also need to check the numbers proposed in the neighbourhood plan are actually deliverable. The council is also aware of another substantial site promoted by the landowner to the community, which has not been considered at all by the community. It's important to the robustness of the plan-making process that all suggested sites are given consideration. That mini Schlar process that we suggested needs to ensure that happens, or the neighbourhood plan could be challenged, legally challenged. The sites that are being suggested, being offered up, if you like, have not been through any sustainability appraisal, which is an essential part of the planning process. This is even more important for Chirston, Gampton, Broadsands, as the strategy of spread the jam thin, I'm not criticising the strategy, spread the jam thin using a high number of small sites is different to the strategy set out in the new local plan, for which sustainability assessment has been undertaken. So, for example, the community's identified has included Greenway Park for development. The local plan Schlar suggested no more than 6 units on that site. The community suggests 10 units. And this site is partly within an area of outstanding natural beauty. So any development will have an impact on that area of outstanding natural beauty. It's these sorts of impacts that need to be assessed as part of a sustainability appraisal. That hasn't been done yet. If the sites promoted by Chirston, Gampton, Broadsands Community Partnership were now added to the council's 5-year land supply and therefore to the local plan, extra work would be needed to cover the lack of sustainability appraisal. This is exactly what the local plan inspector has warned against. It would require the local plan hearing to be postponed and the local plan to be delayed. I just want to touch on windfall sites because the offer is, I'm sure, genuinely made and it is being taken up, and I just want to cover that point. Based on Tollway's past record and national planning policy advice, the council's 5-year housing land supply allows for 130 new homes per annum on windfall sites. Those are sites are defined in Tollway as sites of less than 6 homes and are not identified in the local plan. They are what they say on the tin, if you like, windfall sites. The community has identified quite a large number of small sites in Chirston, Gampton and Broadsands, many of which will deliver less than 6 homes. Some of these will be delivered as windfall sites in the next 5 years. Waterside Quarry is one of them. The Weary Plyman site is another, following the appropriate assessment of each site as part of the planning process and the granting of planning permission. As such, sites in Chirston, Gampton and Broadsands are already contributing to the council's 5-year land supply. Other sites which will be allocated to the neighbourhood plan following proper assessment and consultation and referendum will usefully form part of Tollway's housing land supply over the medium to long term. However, these sites are not yet included in the neighbourhood plan that has reached an advanced stage, so cannot be guaranteed to remain within the plan. And by definition, these sites don't have planning permission. There's absolutely no guarantee they can be delivered in 5 years, so they cannot realistically be included in the council's 5-year land supply. For reasons given above, they can't be included in the local plan. So as officers, we very much appreciate the offer, and some of that offer has already been picked up through windfall sites. But as officers, we don't recommend it's accepted.
Thank you. Any questions on that answer? No. Ken.
Thank you, Chair. And I asked this question and I perhaps didn't ask it as clearly as I might have done. I certainly wasn't suggesting we just offer up sites randomly, and I certainly was not suggesting that we leapfrog essentially legally required components of the plan-making process. Far from it. So I'll ask my question again in perhaps a slightly different way. If the Brixham Peninsula Neighbourhood Plan were to identify additional sites through due process, which mitigated the alleged loss to the 5-year land supply and local plan of the units currently proposed for the 1st and the 18th, would that make a difference? If we could find sites through the proper process that replace this, would that reduce, in officers' eyes, the risk that has been suggested lies in this proposal? Thank you.
I think there's a fairly straightforward response to this, Chair, if I may, and that's really one of timing. What we've warned about, in particular, is the threat to the local plan progression. We have less than a month until the local plan hearing, and that isn't time enough to do the work that I've just set out would be needed as part of the essential process leading up to a local plan hearing. So we couldn't take on board those sites now. Without significant risk to deferring the hearing itself and delaying the local plan.
Councillor Pujar.
Thank you, Chair. I apologise. I don't really sense I've had a straightforward answer to my question. I appreciate there's a time aspect, and I know we probably couldn't do this in a month, but the point being that, you know, other things being equal, if there was the time and if we could bring those sites forward, would it have the effect of mitigating this risk, and would it make officers' advice any different?
I can't give any different advice to the advice already given, Chair. I'm sorry.
Councillor Morey.
Thank you, Chair. Question to Pat. The possible alternative sites available in Brixham that's been mentioned, can you clarify whether those sites have been already dismissed by the community of Brixham? Because as far as I can remember, there was a thorough investigation from about all the sites in Brixham, and it was clear by public consultation that these sites were already dismissed. Excuse me, my stomach's rumbling. Yeah, can you confirm that?
We've suggested, Chair, that there is a mini strategic housing land assessment process, which I think would be very informative for the neighbourhood plan production, in as much as we look at the sites in some depth that the community has identified, and others if that's what the neighbourhood forum wants us to do, and assess their capacity to deliver the sorts of numbers that the community has talked about, the sort of timing of delivery, and the sort of barriers to delivery that might need to be overcome.
Councillor Stockman.
It's not really what this is all about, because this is a call-in, you know, and not all the rest of it. But I can't just sit here with my mouth shut, being the chair of the Neighbourhood Forum. All through this process, Brixham has not been engaged with the decision-making within Chirsten Gampton and Broadsands. They have done their own village design statements, their own choices of land. The difference is with Brixham, Brixham's main sites are already schla, you know, so the degree of sustainability and deliverability within Brixham is a lot different than is in Chirsten. And I think that's what Pat was actually alluding to, is the work required should there be, and I know at the next meeting there will be more developers coming forward with land, but the trouble is, it's not the time. We're making decisions that are premature, whereas if we had 6 months, it would be a different thing. But it's just unfortunate that it's at this time. So the timing isn't right. Basically, that's how I see it. You know, it's difficult for Chirsten Gampton Broadsands to find the land. You know, it's very difficult, which is why they've gone for small groupings of houses, which is understandable. We all understand that. But the facts of life are that we're X amount of distance through neighbourhood planning, and one area have chosen one way of doing things, and the other area has chosen another way of doing things. And so we're at a tipping point, I would say. So you can't just conjure a piece of land out of the air and say it's deliverable.
Can you let Pat answer, please?
Sorry, Chair, I wasn't aware there was a question in there. I was just trying to clarify, yeah. And that wasn't a critical statement.
Do you agree with
what I say? That's a question.
I should clarify that what I meant was the new sites that have been identified by the community and the sites where a greater amount of housing has been identified by the community over and above what the local plan schlar identified.
Thank you very much indeed. Can we move on to question, put my glasses on, 8.
Chair, the question was further explanation of why no compensation could be claimed. Chair, what I've attempted to set out is the clarity that any proposed covenant over land cannot be in conflict with the terms of a lease over the land unless both parties agree to vary the terms of the same. Members will recall that at the council meeting there was an amended covenant that was put forward, which was different than the one that the community had put forward, so as to ensure that the proposed covenant did not conflict with the terms of the lease. What I've attempted to do is set out two examples which explains the situation. Because the covenant doesn't include development which is permitted under the terms of the user clause within the lease, that is, as a golf club or as agriculture. So the example would be if the golf club were to build a new clubhouse. Clearly that is in pursuance of it being a golf club, and therefore the covenant would not require the subject matter to go out to referendum. If, however, in contrasting, there was a proposal to build a hotel on the land, clearly that's not as agriculture, that's not as golf club, and therefore the covenant would require the referendum to be undertaken. That differentiates and shows how the lease isn't impacted by the covenant, and that is why no compensation is payable or claimable under the terms of the covenant.
Councillor Pritchard.
Thank you, Chair. Just a very specific question. I think you've already answered this, Amory, but I just want to be absolutely clear. If this covenant was granted, you are saying that this would not, I'll phrase it as a statement, this would not prevent the golf club, Churston Golf Club, building a new clubhouse within the existing curtilage of their lease.
That's correct.
Thank you very much indeed. Question 9, unless there's any questions on number 8. Question 9.
Chair, the question related to clarification of the number of people who signed the petition. The Council in its constitution has a petition scheme, and that sets out that the deadline for receipt of petitions is 10 clear working days before the Council meeting. The Council therefore records the number of signatures, valid signatures, that are received at that point. Some petitioners choose to keep their petitions open after it has been formally received by the Council, which is why the petitioners may be reporting higher numbers than that. But for the Council purposes, it is the number that are received by the petition deadline, and in this instance, that was a figure of 2,053 valid signatures.
I think that's an unequivocal answer. Thank you very much indeed. Question 10.
Chair, this question was, in summary, if there's a legal challenge, does the Council A, have the necessary finances to defend the action, and B, are there sufficient staffing levels to engage with what could be a long drawn out process? Chair, the Council does have a modest budget for external legal fees, such as the use of counsel. However, any sums in excess of that would need to be met from the Comprehensive Spending Review Reserve. And as members know, that reserve is a finite reserve, and therefore any use of it limits its ability to be used in the future. In terms of staffing levels within legal services, as with all council departments, staffing resources within the legal team have diminished over the last few years. The remaining legal team constantly have to prioritise their workload to meet the priorities and demands that are placed upon it from all sectors of the council. However, clearly, if there were to be a legal challenge, that would be a priority, and that work, other work, would have to wait whilst that was being undertaken.
Thank you very much indeed. To that one, so could we go to question 11, please?
Yes, Chairman. Question 11 was, if litigation was proposed against the council, would it stop the local plan process? Now, it's our belief that it wouldn't automatically stop the local plan process. If there was litigation against the council, the decision whether to proceed or not with the local plan process is down to the local plan inspector. And the inspector has made comments on this issue, which were reported to the last meeting. Potentially a problem from the inspector's perspective, I think, is a good way of summarising it, mainly having regard to impact on the five-year land supply and the deliverability of the plan, having regard to the other public sector sites that are proposed to go in the plan.
Any questions? No. Question 12, please.
Chair, the question was, is the case of Graham versus Easington District Council relevant to the situation? The simple answer, Chair, to that is no. Specifically, the facts of that case was that in that case, the council was the beneficiary of a restrictive covenant. In this case, the proposed covenant would not have the council as a beneficiary, and therefore its facts are not applicable to this case.
Okay, what I'll do now is go to question 14. 13 does lead us into the pink paper, and I'm doing it that way around just in case any member does want to address the pink paper. So question 14, please.
Chair, question 14 is, what is the possibility of the covenant being removed by reference to the Lands Tribunal? Chair, in summary, any application to the Tribunal is a lengthy process, and there would be a period by which objections could be raised. Fundamentally, however, an application to the Tribunal would only likely be successful if the fundamental characteristics of the area had changed. If there are the beneficiaries that would currently be the recipients of the covenant, if they remained in place and the characteristics of the area remained as it is, then it would not be likely that any application would be successful.
No questions on 14. Okay, now we come to the pink paper. I understand Councillor Pritchard would like to go into the pink paper, that's fine. It is for this board to decide. I would recommend that we do, because we need a complete, open and fair calling. Could I have a proposer for going into part two, please? Councillor Stockman, a seconder. Councillor Bobby Davies, could we have those in favour, please? It is unanimous. Now, just to explain to the public, I'm afraid that we will, and don't go yet, let me finish, thank you. We will be going into part two. Now, part two is a mechanism by where papers are absolutely confidential and not for issuing outside of members. I will declare this meeting as going into part two in a moment, but when it is declared, I'd be very grateful if the press and the public could move into another area in this building. We will ensure that an officer comes through to get you back when we're finished. I suggest that there is an excellent restaurant along here where you can get a cup of coffee or whatever you want, a sandwich. So I will now be declaring that this moves into part two.